This is the last lecture in the set of early lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Christian Mystery. It is the seventh section, however, it is only one lecture, it's the epilogue, entitled Christianity Began as a Religion, but is Greater than a Religion, given May 13, 1908 in Berlin. I have stated in previous lectures that the concept of religion came to have real meaning only during the post-Atlantean epoch. Before the great Atlantean flood, there could not have been anything like what we term religion, because the very existence of religion implies that people, the vast majority anyway, do not have direct perception or vision of the supersensible. Religion means the rebinding of humanity to the supersensible after the realities of the supersensible world have become imperceptible to the ordinary people. Religion can be conveyed only through prophets, seers, sages, mystery enactments, and so on, as it has been for the past 1,000 years or so. Before the Atlantean flood, our ancestors lived in the regions of the ancient continent of Atlantis, and all human beings were still able to experience and perceive, more or less directly, the supersensible. Religion was unnecessary as long as people actually lived in the spiritual world, and were able to experience it just as we experience the material world today. Toward the end of the Atlantean period, experience of the supersensible faded for the greater majority of people, replaced by the sensory experience we know now. But has anything remained from this ancient Atlantean epoch? When we go back to the distant past by studying the sagas and myths, allowing the teaching of the Germanic gods to affect us, we find communications from spiritual worlds arrayed in pictures. Such communications are not, as academic scholarship would have us believe, contrived images or personifications created by the folk imagination. Rather, they are real memories of those ancient days when people themselves still knew what they had experienced. The sagas of Wotan, Thor, and so on are such memories. What has remained in the post-Atlantean epoch to this day is preeminently a kind of memory religion. Its greatest advance was made among southern Asians, the Indians, whereas in Europe it assumed a different form. In India, the memory of the time when every human being had direct perception of the spiritual world expressed itself as a longing for that world. Reality was thought of as an illusion or Maya, and people yearned for the old days. Yoga was the term given to the means whereby certain individuals acquired the actual capacity to penetrate into the supersensible worlds. Not all the cultures had progressed sufficiently to have among them sages who could achieve the heights of yoga. Some peoples, particularly in northern Europe, had to be content with the memories. There, initiates too penetrated the spiritual worlds, and also had direct experiences of the world of the gods. But their Nordic nature made it difficult for this to be achieved by many. Those experiences were the basis of northern mythology. But we find a common element among all these early people, something that had remained in the people of those post-Atlantean times. It echoed the far more highly developed power of memory possessed by the Atlanteans. During the Atlantean epoch, the power of memory was very different from what it is today. People remembered much farther back, even to the life of remote ancestors. People knew what an ancestor had experienced centuries before. They knew this with as much certainty as old people today know that they what they experienced in their youth. These memories of the ancestors were the basis of what we may call the ancestor cult, ancestor worship. That is actually the first form of religion. Memory had, to some extent, preserved its living power. It was so active and alive that in individual cases, even if they were unable to reach the heights of yoga, a spiritual condition could set in where the ancestor common to a whole people appeared to them in dreams or in certain psychic states. The living figure known to such a tribe as the ancestor of their community was not merely an image of legend, but was a real being who from time to time appeared to people in states of psychic consciousness and accompanied a whole culture. The experiences of the ethnic groups that streamed through Europe were very diverse, but one such experience remained active and living for many people, and they in turn narrated it to those who trusted and believed in them. This was the vision of the ancestor, who gave them counsel from the spirit realm and remained linked with them. This ancestor appeared at crucial moments and at times of perplexity. The ancestor cult was something that remained alive through the physical qualities of the ancestors. This cult of the ancestors developed increasingly into a kind of religious system, worked out, it is true, by certain initiates, though acceptable to many who are not initiated. Such religious systems arose in various regions, for example, as the Brahmanism of ancient India. The last echoes of this may be found in the Vedanta philosophy, but we also find echoes of this ancient pantheism in the earliest systems of philosophy. In Brahmanism, we have in truth a kind of esoteric pantheism. This element can also be perceived in the religious system of the Egyptians, and in that of the Hebrews too. In fact, we can imagine that the origin of this religious system was the gradual unfolding of a more comprehensive idea of the divine being, pervading and vitalizing all things. An ancestor grew together with the spiritual foundations of existence, and became, as it were, a kind of primordial spiritual power. In anthropomorphism, as we may call it, we find a particular form of this esoteric pantheism. The various gods are pictured in images resembling the human form. Greek religion is an example of this. But it would be quite wrong to imagine that for a cultured Greek, the one unified spiritual world did not reign supreme behind their various gods. When we speak of angels, archangels, and so on, of all the different spiritual beings arranged above humanity, as was done in outlining the process of cosmic evolution, we are speaking exactly as people spoke in those ancient times of Zeus, Athena, and the rest in relation to the one world spirit. A unified concept of the universe was behind that system. Pantheism is the spiritual substratum of things. Then the gods are presented as human beings. What factor, then, was responsible for the transition of esoteric pantheism, with its far more abstract character, into the multifarious world of the Greek gods? This question recognizes, in that transition, a deep, essential need of humankind, a principle profoundly rooted in human evolution. When we observe the transition from the Egyptian to the Greek, we see the development of this principle in its most elegant form. In all conceptual life before the Greeks, there is something powerful and symbolic. The Egyptian pyramids and sphinxes are sublime, powerful creations of the human spirit, pointing in a rather abstract way to a spiritual ground of being that humanity does not yet dare to fashion. The Greek spirit convincingly proved its ability to express the spiritual in images. Tremendous progress is in evidence everywhere. When we understand the principle of pure architecture, we find this transition expressed in its finest form in the architectural development from the East to the Greek. In Greek buildings, the principle of the architectural design finds its truest expression. Nowhere do we find such a complete outpouring of thought into outer form as in Greek architecture. Everything is given its position in space in perfect accord with the great cosmic laws. There is perhaps only one other instance where architectural science may be found in human evolution, in Gothic architecture. Contrasting the Gothic with the Greek idea of architecture, one must nevertheless say that Gothic building is not really pure architecture at all, but an expression, no more than a suggestion in its forms, of the mystical element finding its way into the human feeling life. Gothic building is thus not a full expression of architectural science. Greek temples, by contrast, are dwellings of the gods in the fullest sense. If we conceive of a god working creatively in space, his forces pouring through space, as it were, building a raiment for himself, then we are thinking of a Greek temple. As it exists there before us, we know that it is the dwelling of the god. This is not true of the Gothic cathedral. It is a house of prayer. It is inconceivable without those who gather within it, for whom it provides the proper setting and atmosphere. Think of the Greek temple, standing there complete in itself, but permeated with life by the god. There is the temple as it really is. It must not be interpreted in any symbolic way. The faithful and their devotions are a part of the Gothic cathedral. And anyone who conceives of space, not as a void but permeated by forces, knowing that forces crystallize in space and truly discerning these forces, feels that dynamic cosmic forces have crystallized in the Greek temple. Those who feel this with such intensity that they can actually perceive these realities know that forces are always darting through space. The Greeks knew that space is permeated with life. Comparing Roman and Greek architecture is the best way to understand how the Greeks brought thinking, feeling, and willing to actual expression. In Roman architecture, it is often clear that the pillar, for example, has been diverted from its true purpose in space, that is, to bear or support. There is greatness in Roman architecture, too, but it has an element of the purely decorative in it, for example, its pillars, for which there is no deeper reason. The feeling for space is lacking. The pillar stands there but does not fulfill its function and purpose. All these things are related to evolutionary stages of the human spirit. It was only through anthropomorphism that humanity could be prepared for the concept of the divine human, or God dwelling in human beings themselves. But that is Christianity. In Christianity, all the various divine forms flow into the living figure of Jesus Christ. This required an immense deepening on the part of humankind, a deepening that has enabled human beings to conceive not only of space in the living form expressed in Greek plastic art, but to rise to the thought of the internal becoming visible outwardly, the belief that the eternal has in fact lived on earth as historical reality in space and time. That is the essence of Christianity, and it indicated the great advance that human beings could achieve on earth. We need only compare, as indeed we should, the Greek temple, which is a dwelling place of the god, with what later became the Christian church, having its purest expression in Gothic architecture. And we shall realize that an actual retrogression is inevitable in the outer forms when the aim is to present the eternal in terms of the temporal and spatial. The achievements of Gothic art in bringing the inner to outer expression stand under the influence of the Christian stream of spiritual life. It is understandable, after all, that architecture should reach its greatest beauty in an age when the whole human soul was still united with the outer forces streaming through space. We see, therefore, how in the post-Atlantean epoch, the thought underlying religion steadily deepens, how people seek to find means whereby to give intimations of the supersensible. In everything I have said here, it will not be difficult to perceive indications of human longing to rivet the supersensible by some means or other into outer form. This is the primal aim of art. With Christianity we have, as it were, reached our own times. From what has here been said in conjunction with other aspects of the evolution of the post-Atlantean epoch of which we have heard, it will be clear that the course of human life strives more and more toward interiorization, spiritualization. Moreover, in the different races, there is an ever-increasing consciousness of the quality of inwardness, or spirit, in the outer form. It may truly be said that in the figures of the Greek gods, we see how all that lives inwardly in humanity pours itself into the external world. Christianity itself constitutes the greatest impulse in this direction. In the wake of Christianity, we see the emergence of what is today called science. What goes by this name, the recognition of the primal thought foundation of existence, actually began in Chaldean times. In our own age, we are living at a great turning point in the evolution of humanity. Reviewing what we have been considering in brief outline, let us ask ourselves, why has all this happened as it has? Why is it that humanity has developed to the stage of impressing the inner into outer form? The answer is that the development of our organism has impelled us to do so. The ancient Atlanteans were able to perceive in the supersensible world because in them the etheric body had not drawn completely into the physical body. One point in the etheric body did not coincide with the corresponding point in the physical body. The complete coincidence of the two bodies is the cause of the fact that humanity is now being impelled more and more into the external world. Once the gates to the supersensible world were closed, humanity needed for its artistic development a link, a connection, between the material and supersensible worlds. Earlier in the Atlantean epoch, they had no such need, for at that time they were still able to know the supersensible world in immediate experience. Human beings did not need to be told of the gods and spirits until they had lost the power of perceiving these beings, just as one need tell only those who have never seen them of the existence of plants. That is the basis of religious development in the post-Atlantean epoch. Why, then, was it necessary for a supersensible being such as Christ to appear in a finite personality, in Jesus, and sojourn on earth? Why did Christ have to become an historical personality? Why did the gaze of human beings have to be riveted on this divinity? We have heard that people were no longer able to gaze into the supersensible world. What had to take place in order that God might become for them an experienced reality? God had to become perceptible to the senses, to incarnate in a physical body. There you have the answer to the question. As long as human beings were able to perceive the spiritual, as long as they were aware of the gods in supersensible experience, no God need have become human. But now God must be present within the world of sense. Words of the disciples to the effect that they had laid their hands in his wounds are a confirmation of this fact. Thus the very nature of post-Atlantean humanity explains the appearance of Jesus Christ, and we understand why Christ had inevitably to reveal himself to the eyes of sense. The most intensely real historical fact had to be presented to humanity. The spirit self had to become a reality in the world of sense in order that human beings might have a means of achieving connection with the supersensible world. Science, as such, degenerated more and more into veneration of the external material world. Today a climax has been reached in this respect. Moreover, Christianity afforded no strong support against this absorption in the material world. Christianity in its deeper aspect must be grasped today by spiritual scientific insight in order to stand before humanity in the light of a new understanding. In the Middle Ages, there was still a living link between science and Christianity. Today, what is needed if Christianity is to be grasped in all its profundity is a deepening of knowledge and of wisdom itself in relation to supersensible realities. We are standing at the threshold of a spiritual conception of Christianity, the next step being spiritual scientific Christianity. On the other hand, the science that is concerned entirely with the physical and the material world will gradually lose all connection with the supersensible worlds. What then is the task of spiritual science? Can those who are seekers after the spirit look up to science in its accepted form today? Mainstream modern science will align itself more and more closely with the course of post-Atlantean evolution, concerning itself entirely with the outer, the physical, the material, and steadily losing all connection with the spiritual world. Follow any science you like back into earlier times, and you will find how much spirituality was then contained in it. You will find evidence everywhere, in medicine and in other domains too, of how the connection with the spiritual world has vanished. Wherever you look, you will find this is so. This is inevitable, for the nature of the post-Atlantean epoch is such that the original link with the supersensible world is bound to disappear more and more completely. One can predict the inevitable trend of science today. Whatever attempts may be made here and there, external science will not be capable of spiritual deepening. Science will steadily become a body of directives for the acquisition of technical skill into a means of mastering the outer world. For the Pythagoreans, mathematics was still a means of acquiring insight into the higher worlds, into the harmonies of the spheres. For modern science, mathematics is a means for the development of technology, and thereby for mastering the external world. External science will inevitably tend in the direction of the secular and unphilosophical. Spiritual development is the source from which human beings will have to derive their impulses. This spiritual development is the path to spiritual Christianity, and spiritual science will be the source of the impulses for this spiritual life. Science is increasingly becoming a collection of directives for technical achievements. The universities are steadily turning into technical training schools. This is regarded as right and proper today. But what is spiritual will develop into a free human possession, one not fettered to science. Then science will appear in quite a different setting, in quite a different form. Therefore, for humanity today, one thing must happen. The link with the momentous experience of the supersensible world must be renewed. How essential this is will be clear to you if you realize what will befall if this link is not reestablished. The etheric head is now drawn completely into the human being. The connection of the etheric body with the physical body has now reached its deepest point. Hence, the percentage of human beings capable of supersensible experience has never been lower than it is at present. But the evolution of humanity advances in such a way that a re-emergence of the etheric body comes about of itself. With the coming of Christ, the etheric body began to loosen again from the physical body. It is becoming more and more independent and free, and in the future will again be outside the physical body as it was before. The process of the loosening of the etheric body has already begun. But human beings must take with them in their emerging etheric bodies what they have experienced in their physical bodies. Above all, they must take with them the physical event of Golgotha, experienced in physical earthly existence. Otherwise they will have lost something irrevocably. Their etheric bodies will emerge without bearing with them the one essential reality. Such people will face emptiness in their etheric bodies. But those who have experienced the realities of spiritual Christianity, will possess in their etheric bodies the abundant fruits of what they have experienced in the physical body. The danger is greatest among those who, misguided by external science, have turned away from the spiritual truths. But the emergence of the etheric body is already in process, and the nervous symptoms and evidence in our time are a sign of it. These nervous troubles will steadily increase. If in the loosening of our etheric bodies we do not take with us the greatest of all experiences possible for us in the physical body. True, we still have plenty of time, as far as the great masses of the people are concerned. The process is very long. Nevertheless, there are individuals who have already now reached the point of achievement. In the end, however, those who will never have recognized, through experience in physical existence, the greatest of all the events in the physical world, who will never have known or incorporated in their etheric bodies the deep realities contained in Christianity, will face what is called spiritual death. Spiritual death will be the consequence of the emptiness of the etheric body. Atlantean human beings, with their clairvoyance, needed no religion, because experience of the supersensible was immediate reality to them. All human development proceeded from such conditions. Vision of the spiritual world then faded away. Religare means to bind back. Religion is the rebinding of the sensible with the supersensible. In an age of approaching materialism, human beings needed religion. But the time will come when they will again be able to experience the supersensible world. Then they will no longer need religion. The necessary antecedent of the new vision is that human beings shall be bearers of spiritual Christianity. This is the basis of the sentence of which I would ask you to realize the profound significance. Christianity began as a religion, but is greater than all religions. What Christianity bestows goes with us into all ages of time to come, and will still be one of the essential impulses in humanity when religion as we know it is no longer in existence. Even when religion as such has been transcended, Christianity will remain. The fact that it was first of all a religion is connected with the evolutionary process of humanity, but Christianity as a worldview is greater than all religions. The end of the last lecture in section 7 of the early lectures of Rudolf Steiner entitled The Christian Mystery, and that's the end of this book.